All right. The outline of the Gospel of John. And again, we have gone through the first four sections. Last week, we ended up with chapter 17, the Lord's Prayer, his intercessory prayer for his people. I hope you enjoyed that section, chapters 13 through 17. It's a lifetime of study, just to go through just those chapters, to study all the details, learn about Christ and his ministry, his message to his people, chapters 13 through 17. But tonight we open up with chapter 18, which is the next section, the particulars of the crucifixion of Christ. It's because John gives us some details that are not found in the other Gospels. Keep in mind that John is emphasizing the deity of Christ. A lot of the sufferings of Christ, John did not include in his account because he's not presenting Jesus as the suffering servant, but rather God in the flesh, God in the human. And chapter 18 is a great chapter for understanding the deity of Christ. If we can understand the details, that's great. But the underlying message and presentation of John in John chapter 18 is how much God is in control. And if we study and understand it, we can better understand and trust the Lord even in our own lives. John chapter 18, verses 1 through 11, the private surrender of Jesus. It was done in private. The place was picked by the Lord because he knew there he would be away from the crowds so that they could take him. He says in verse 1, when Jesus had spoken these words, that would be everything in chapters 13 through 17. Ending off with the prayer. But when Jesus was finished with these words, he went forth, or went out with his disciples over the brook Kedron. This would be the Kidron Valley, right between Jerusalem and the Mount of Olives. It's called the brook Kedron because it flows in the wintertime, and that's what the word brook means in Greek. It means winter flow. Where there was a garden, and this is at the foot or the base of the Mount of Olives, into which he entered and his disciples. This is the place where Jesus spent his evenings with, many of them with the disciples. And Judas also, which betrayed him. In the Greek text, the word betrayed is a present participle. The one who is in the process of betraying him. He knew the place. He'd gone there many times before with Jesus and the disciples. For Jesus oftentimes resorted or gathered there with his disciples. So he knew that Judas had gone out. He's finished instructing the disciples. So he goes to the garden where Judas knows where to find him. And Judas, in verse 3 then, having received a band of men and officers. The word band actually means a cohort of soldiers, which was a group of some 600 soldiers. It's a spera in Greek. So Judas, that had 600 soldiers with him, and officers. These would be the temple police. So not only does he have an army contingent, but he also has the temple police, and some of the historians say that there was at least 1,000 people came out to take Jesus. They came from the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they came there with lanterns and torches and weapons. The word weapons means clubs. I can understand the lanterns and torches, it's nighttime, but they came with clubs, 1,000 of them, to take Jesus and his 11 men. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went out and said unto them, "Whom are you seeking?" Notice it says, Jesus, knowing all things that was going to come. The Lord knows it all. He knows every event that is happening. He knew they were coming. He knew what Judas was going to do. So what does he do? He goes out to meet them. Knowing all things, he goes out to meet them and he says to them, "Whom are you seeking?" They answered and said unto him, "Jesus of Nazareth," or more literally in the Greek text, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus said unto them, follow closely, because it's different than any of the English translations. Jesus said unto them, "I am." Didn't say he. It's not like we don't have name tags, so we'll just go around and introduce ourselves. He didn't do that. Whom are you looking for? Jesus the Nazarene. He says, "I am." Ego eimi, that's the name of God in the Old Testament. In Exodus chapter 3, verse 14, Moses was sent by God to stand before Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." So Moses says to God, "But if Pharaoh asks me who sent you, what is his name?" God says, "Tell him I am that I am." And the Greek word just means existent one. He is the eternally existent one. He had no beginning, he has no end. He always is. Remember, we've gone over this before about the space-time dimension in which we live. We're the ones that have trouble waiting on the Lord. So much time goes by. Seems like God just doesn't answer. He doesn't have a problem. He's not restricted by time. For him, it's always now. So he gives them the name of God in the Old Testament. Jesus said, "I am," and Judas also, the one betraying him, had been standing with them. And as soon as he had said unto them, "I am," they went backward and fell to the ground. All of them, including Judas. Then he asked them again, "Now who are you looking for?" And they said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Now, if they had any sense of awe, when he asked the second time, "Who are you looking for?" I would have said, "Never mind, he's not here." I would have just turned around and gone the other way. Why is Jesus doing this? To show that he is in charge. Remember back in John chapter 10, he told the disciples, "No one takes my life from me. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it back again." So they fell over. They said, "We're here to see, looking for Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus answered, "I have told you that I am. If therefore you are seeking me," those of you in the Greek class will recognize that as a first-class condition assumed to be true. He's saying, since therefore you are seeking me, check this out, it's a command. Let these go their way. He's not asking permission, it's a command, imperative mood. That the saying might be fulfilled which he spoke of them, those whom thou gavest to me, I have lost none. Back in John chapter 17, verse 12. Now he told them that soon they will scatter. That's at the cross. Now he's saying, allow these disciples to leave. That's his protection. Remember, he said in John chapter 10 that the shepherd goes out and he faces the wolf. A hireling won't do that. So not only is it provision that a shepherd gives, but protection. And here's Jesus fulfilling in his prayer that all that the Father has given him, he has not lost one. And so they had to let him go. Why? Because Jesus commanded it. So now it's Jesus alone with 1,000 people. So Simon Peter, seeing that Jesus was going to be left alone, he drew out a sword and he struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Luke tells us that Jesus took the ear, part of the ear that was cut off, and put it back on and healed the servant. But remember, Peter, in his impulsiveness, very impulsive person, but remember, he made a commitment that though all the other disciples would be offended in Jesus, he would not be. I'll go with you to death. And Jesus said, no, you're going to deny me. So Peter's trying to keep his commitment. But you'll notice through all of his efforts, it's all human effort, impulsive. I got to do it because I said it. Can't take the Lord's word for it that that's the kind of person that he is or the kind of people that we are. Weak in the flesh. So Jesus, verse 11, says to Peter, put up your sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father has given to me, shall I not drink it? The Father's given me the cup. He's saying, Peter, it's God's plan here. Peter, don't you understand that everything that's happening is according to God's plan? I just showed you that I'm in charge here. Our identification is with Peter. We analyze situations and are human. We say, certainly God can't want this to happen. We take our swords out and start fighting. But we don't see that God's in charge. Starting in verses 12 to 14, the preliminary appearance before Annas. And from this point on, we're going to see what John is presenting to us, a contrast. Segments of two different scenes. One is Peter, and one is the trial of Jesus. And John is going to switch back and forth between the two, contrasting the weakness of man. This is not to put Peter down. Nowhere does Jesus ever condemn him. He just gave him a simple fact that you're going to deny me. And Peter said, no, not me. And Jesus, you remember, said, I'll pray that your faith will not fail you. Well, it didn't. God's faith kept him. It was God's ordained circumstances to put Peter through to show Peter who he really is. Compared to the Almighty God. So the two contrasts is between God and the weakness of man. Remember my New Testament verse, John 15:5, where Jesus said, "Without me, you cannot do one thing." We keep trying. We keep trying. We'll see in chapter 21 that after Peter denies him here, he will be restored back to fellowship, back to the commission of feeding the flock of God. And Peter will be used to give the first sermon in Acts chapter 2. He will be used for the healing of a man outside of the temple. And the people are going to rush up to him and John, and they're going to be all excited and looking to them. And the first thing Peter says is, "Don't look to us as though we have done anything. Jesus, whom you crucified, healed this man." So you can see that Peter learned his lesson. He's going through the training that every believer needs in order to be useful for Christ. We saw the perfect example in John the Baptist, Yochanan HaMetzbil. How he said about his relationship with Jesus, that Jesus must increase and he must decrease. And how that he's just the friend of the bridegroom. He's not the main attraction. He just rejoices that the bride and bridegroom come together. It's hard to be used by the Lord in ministry and kind of stay out of sight. Stay out of the action. Except when the Lord uses you. The main point is to bring people to Christ and Christ to people. And to see people walk with Christ in a relationship. So we have a contrast going on. The way the Holy Spirit led John to write, verse 12, the preliminary appearance before Annas. Now you must know who Annas and Caiaphas are. Annas is the high priest, the official high priest of the Jews. They only had one high priest at a time, and the high priest ruled in that position and office until he died. But the Roman government said, "We want our own man in there to be the high priest who's going to be sensitive to the Roman government." So they picked Caiaphas. Now, what makes things interesting is that Caiaphas is the son-in-law to Annas. So I'm sure their family dinners were very interesting. But it is interesting, Annas is the official high priest as far as the Jews were concerned. And so it tells us in verse 12 that the band and the captain of the and the officers of the Jews took Jesus and bound him. Now, if you've done any study on Roman law and Jewish law, you know that under both circumstances, it was illegal to bind anyone that has not been found guilty of a crime. But it is also interesting that Jesus, as we'll see a little later, Jesus will be like the Passover lamb that is bound. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he who gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient or profitable that one man should die for the people. Back in John chapter 11, verses 49 and 50, he stood up and he says, "Don't you know that one man must die for the whole nation?" But in John's commentary, he said Caiaphas really didn't know what he was saying. He was prophesying and didn't even know it. God was using him. Plus, Caiaphas has been looking for Jesus. He wants Jesus dead. It was interesting that God would use him for the prophecy. Verse 15. So we see Jesus in front of Annas, but now we switch to Peter, the permission given to Peter. And Simon Peter followed Jesus. And so did another disciple. Many believe this is the Apostle John. That disciple was known unto the high priest and went in with Jesus into the palace of the high priest. But Peter stood at the door outside. So this contingent comes through and now they're in the courtyard, a walled courtyard. And there's a young gal keeping the door. Jesus goes through, the band of soldiers comes through, and this disciple who's known to the high priest, he gets in. It's kind of like saying, Peter, you don't have a press pass, you know. So the door is closed and he can't go in. He's standing outside. Then went out that other disciple, which was known unto the high priest, and spoke unto her that kept the door and brought in Peter. So Peter's my guest. Like I say, most people theorize that it's John, but other people think that it might be Nicodemus, which would be interesting. Then saith the young girl that kept the door unto Peter. This is as he's coming in. Art not thou also one of this man's disciples? And Peter says, I am not. And the servants and the officers stood there who had made a fire of coals. Please keep that phrase in mind. Because in chapter 21, when Peter is restored to fellowship, it'll be over coals, fire of coals, a breakfast that Jesus will prepare. For it was cold, and they warmed themselves, and Peter stood with them and warmed himself. Then verses 19 to 24, back to the preliminary trial, the high priest then asked Jesus of his disciples and of his doctrine. And Jesus answered him and said, I spoke openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple where the Jews always gather. And in secret I have said nothing. Why are you asking me? A second point about judicial law in those days was that, in fact, it's from the Roman judicial system that we got the, I plead the fifth. I'm not going to testify. But it was illegal at that time, both through the Jewish system and the Roman system, to even ask an accused to speak for himself. Even if he confessed to the crime, the court could not accept it. You must provide at least two witnesses for a person to be convicted. So when he's asking Jesus about himself and his doctrine and his disciples, he said, well, I've spoken openly and publicly. Everybody knows what I've taught. Everybody knows what my doctrine is. And by the way, why are you asking me? Ask the people that heard me what I have said to them. Behold, they know what I said. So basically, he's helping them out. Don't ask me because you're not supposed to. It's against the law. Find some people that heard me teach. Get two witnesses. Gather them up. And when he spoke this way, one of the officers who stood by struck Jesus with the palm of his hand and said, do you answer the high priest so? That also is against the law. To hit someone that is accused, he hasn't been found guilty. Why is he hitting him? So Jesus said, if I have spoken evil, literally inappropriately, bear witness of the evil. But if I've spoken well, that is according to the lines of the law, why do you smite me? Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. So Annas said, I got to get rid of him. So he sent him to Caiaphas to see if Caiaphas, what Caiaphas wants to do. Because they can't find any criminal charge. They can't find any witnesses. They don't know what to do with him. Verse 25, the public denial by Peter, back to the scene with Peter. And Simon Peter stood and warmed himself. They said therefore unto him, art not thou also one of his disciples? And he denied it and said, I am not. Now one of the servants of the high priest, being his relative whose ear Peter cut off, he was out there in the garden. He says, hey, you cut one of my relative's ears off. I remember you. You're the guy wielding the sword out there. You're one of them. Did not I see thee in the garden with him? Peter then denied again, and immediately the cock or rooster crew. Luke tells us that he went out and wept bitterly. He remembered the words of Jesus. In fact, it happened right at the time when Jesus was walking out of the high priest's office and their eyes met. And Peter remembered that he had said that he would deny him. And he went out and wept bitterly because he looked at himself as a failure. Jesus never condemned him. Peter was disappointed in himself. I made a commitment to the Lord and I couldn't keep it. I said I'd even die with him. Boy, I drew out that sword and started hacking away. I'll die with him. Even went so far as to hang around the fire out in the courtyard. Sometimes it's easier to fight and die than it is to live and represent Christ. So he denied him. Back in John 13, verse 38, Jesus told him that he would. John 18, 28 to 38, the probing of Jesus by Pilate. Now, Pilate is now with the Roman government. In all, Jesus had three religious trials and three civil trials, six trials in all. John doesn't give us all of them because Jesus went to Annas and Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin and then over to Pilate. Very interesting about Pilate. He's a very interesting character. He ruled as governor from 26 to 36 AD. And here's basically, if you want to understand why Pilate's having such a struggle, because he will admit to the crowd that there's nothing wrong with Jesus. He didn't commit any crime. I find no fault with this man. Well, the easy solution, I mean, you're the man, you know? Let him go and tell the Jews, too bad. Well, how Pilate took office is very interesting. You remember Herod the Great, who was ruling at the birth of Christ. At the time of his death, he had his territory broken down into three sections, and those three sections were left to each of one of his three sons. So instead of one ruling now, we had three different rulers over three different sections of Jerusalem, Galilee, the Judea area. Antipas, Archelaus, and Philip were his sons. Well, Archelaus, and the word the historians use for him is they said he's a punk. I like that. He was 18 years old, and he was just as evil, if not worse, than his father. So what they did is Rome called him in and had him put to death, one of their own rulers, and decided for his territory that they would break it up and let different governors rule over certain sections. So Pilate is one of the governors, and he's in charge of the Jerusalem area. And he's got problems. You have to understand that the Roman leadership was commanded to be in charge, but you couldn't get the Jewish people upset. How are you going to do that? You know, basically, they're held captive by the Roman government. But they gave them freedom. You can exercise your own religious freedom, have your own laws, try your own people, be in charge of your own people. But then the Roman government is over them. So there was always a contingent of soldiers around in the various areas to make sure the Jews keep in line. Well, Pilate started getting in trouble prior to this incident right here. Pilate was getting into trouble. He came back into town one day and he had his flags waving, and the standard bearers were carrying his flags, and on the end of the flagpoles were different characters engraved, eagles and different heads of different animals, just for decoration. Well, the Jews said, "You can't do that. You are corrupting Jerusalem. Those are idols. And we don't believe in worshiping of idols." He didn't even listen to them. So they went to Rome and complained. So the headquarters in Rome sends a message back telling him, "Take them off. Don't get the Jewish people upset." Then at one time, the Jerusalem was having problems with its water. And he said he would take care of the problem for them. He wanted to build an aqueduct and bring in fresh water for all of Jerusalem, just as a gift to help the Jewish people. Except he didn't have the money to do it. So he took a group of soldiers and went over to the temple, and by force he took all the money out of the temple to build this aqueduct, this fresh water system for the city. So the people came to protest in front of his headquarters there in Jerusalem. But he had soldiers dressed like Jewish civilians and dispersed them throughout the crowd that was coming to protest. And when he gave the signal, these undercover agents began to beat up the Jews. Well, that's strike two, because the Jewish people complained to Rome, and Rome came back at him. Then there was a third time, it was actually after this incident, when he decided that he's going to put up shields in Herod's palace there in Jerusalem with the heads of the various kings and rulers and Caesars that have ruled in Rome. And he put up these pictures and these shields up on the wall. Well, the Jews complained again. So that's idolatry, and you are corrupting our city. So they eventually called him in, 36 AD, found him guilty of these violations, and had him killed. That's Pilate. There is a tradition, but only tradition, that once he was handed his sentence, he received Christ. I don't know if that's true or not. Seems like with tradition, everybody receives Christ right when you're sentenced to die. I don't know why that is. So this is Pilate. He's already got two strikes against him. He hasn't put the shields up yet, but, you know, he's been warned twice now. And now all of a sudden the Jewish people are coming to him and they're saying, crucify this man. And he's going, he didn't do anything wrong. We said, crucify him. Yeah, but you don't understand. We can't even have a trial. There's no charge against him. Crucify him anyway. So you can understand, Pilate feels like, if I do not cater and compromise to the Jewish people, they're going to complain against me again. His conclusion is, it's better to give up an innocent man for crucifixion and satisfy the Jews than to have them complain, and he has a third complaint against him. That's the history of Pilate. Verse 28, the probing of Jesus by Pilate, this is the beginning of his civil trials. He's had three religious trials, and they basically said, we don't even have any charges. As a matter of fact, in order to go before a Roman court, there must be charges, accusations, made against them that's sent on ahead of time. It has to be in written form. In fact, many people believe that Luke's writings, Luke and the book of Acts, was compiled by Luke for the defense of Paul when he went to Rome and was put on trial there when he said, I appeal to Caesar. So they led Jesus from Caiaphas unto the hall of judgment. And it was early. We'll find out it's 6 o'clock in the morning. Courts aren't even open yet. The other three were held. The religious hearings were held at night, which is against the law. We'll find that these are being held out of public view. Again, against the law. It was early, and they themselves went not into the judgment hall, lest they should be defiled, but that they might eat the Passover. Very interesting. Since Pilate's palace was Gentile territory, the Jews did not go into Gentile territory, lest they should be considered defiled and cleanse themselves, and they have to wait a whole week. Well, they'd miss Passover. Well, it's interesting that there aren't any scriptures that said that they're defiled if they go into touch Gentile territory. The closest thing to it is Numbers chapter 19, verse 14. Numbers 19:14 talks about touching a dead body, that you're unclean. And you have to wait for your cleansing. This was a rule that they carried out themselves, made up themselves. And what's also interesting is that they would come and they'd say, we can't come into the palace lest we should be defiled, but we want this innocent man murdered. Oh, that's no defilement there. We want to kill the Son of God, but we want to stay religiously pure. So Pilate then went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? That's the legal requirement. They answered and said unto him, if he were not a criminal, a malefactor, we would not have delivered him to you. That's their answer. We don't have one, but if he was not a criminal, we wouldn't have brought him here. Well, that's a good reason why. So Pilate says, You take him and judge him according to your law. The Jews therefore said unto him, it is not lawful for us to put any man to death. It's very interesting. If you went, go trace back through history, we're at about 32 AD when Jesus died in Jerusalem during that Passover week, 32 AD, but around 30 AD. The Talmud, the Jewish register of rules, regulations, and a little bit of history, the Talmud tells us that in 30 AD, the Roman government took the authority away from the Jewish leaders to put someone to death. 2 years before Jesus was there. And we'll see in a moment, even according to their law. We'll see pretty soon that the charge is going to be blasphemy. And in Leviticus 24:16, it says that the one who commits blasphemy must be killed by stoning. But you see what Pilate's doing. He says, you take him and you deal with him according to your law. They said, we can't. It's against Roman law for us to do it, but what Pilate is telling them, I'm giving you the authority. Go do it. Take care of it yourself. They said, oh, no, no. It's against Roman law, even though a Roman governor is saying, go ahead and do it. You see what's happening here? When God says that Messiah must be crucified, God is in charge. Even in the passing of laws prior to his coming, he makes it so that they can't do it themselves, but that they have to go to the Roman government. Only the Roman government can pass down a sentence of crucifixion for a criminal charge. They want him crucified. They won't even stand to have him stoned to death. They're not going to be satisfied until he's hung on the cross as a criminal. They said, it's not lawful for us to put anyone to death. Verse 32, that the saying of Jesus might be fulfilled, which he spake, signifying what death he should die. Jesus began back in chapter 2, verse 19, all the way through the Gospel of John, to tell the people how he must die. Psalm 16:10 gives us the prophecy. Also along with Psalm 22, the messianic psalm of the death of Messiah, we're told both in the Old and the New Testament, in detail in Isaiah chapter 53, what will happen to Messiah. What's also interesting is in Acts chapter 2, in Peter's message, Peter tells the crowd that according to the predetermined counsel of God, you have crucified the Christ. All planned ahead of time. But as we've also seen, as we've spent quite some time studying about Judas, remember the Bible tells us that back in chapter 6, verse 70, Jesus said, have not I chosen you 12, and one of you is a demon? And yet he fulfilled Scripture to betray the Messiah. Jesus did not choose him to be evil. He chose an evil man to perform the evil task. For it tells us that during the Passover meal, when Jesus was celebrating it with the disciples, that Satan entered into Judas and he went out to tell the authorities where Jesus was. He was of the devil prior to Jesus choosing him to be one of the 12. Because someone evil must do the evil task. But even then, God's in charge. When we look at all of this presentation as John is presenting it to us, the failure of man, the weakness of our flesh, and yet how in perfect control God is of the whole thing, both of the evil and the good. Remember what happened to Joseph in the Old Testament? Remember he was thrown into the pit by his brothers because he had a dream. They didn't like it. Pulled him out of the pit and gave him to some merchants going to Egypt. When he got there, he doing his best to walk with God as he should. The wife of the leader tried to seduce him. He runs away, but she grabs his coat. She holds up his coat, says, "The man who owns this coat tried to rape me." They found out it was Joseph, so they threw him in prison. Here he is in jail. For what? He didn't do anything. Falsely accused. And yet we know that eventually he was let out because of a testimony of someone that was in prison that said, "I know of a guy in prison that can tell dreams, tell you the answers to the dreams." So they brought him out. And he told the Pharaoh the answer to the dream. So Pharaoh elevated him to second in command right under him in all of Egypt. Well, the dream was about a famine. And Joseph said, "Store up for yourselves because there's going to be famine." So they did, and of course, with that interpretation of the dream, he saved the Egyptian people from a lot of problems. But what was interesting is the famine also reached back to where his family was, and so his brothers came to Egypt looking for food. I put myself in that situation. I would have had a lot of fun with that one because my brothers would have had to come to me. Of course, they didn't know that was Joseph. They thought he was long gone and dead. But once Joseph did reveal himself to his brothers, he said to them, "You meant it for evil, but God worked it out for good." Isn't that interesting? You worked evil against me, and God turned it around to accomplish his purposes, his good. Reminds me of a story of a man who was shipwrecked. And he came floating up on an island, was there all by himself. And he cried out to God, "Help me." And so he went about the island and he cut down some palm limbs and made himself a little hut to live in. And one day he was out hunting for firewood, and he looked back over the trees and he saw smoke coming up behind the trees. And he ran over there and his hut had burned down. And he says, "Lord, I don't understand this. I need help." Tragedy after tragedy is taking place. And as soon as he said that, he heard some noise and he turned around and here came a boat, a rowboat with some men in it. And out beyond them in the ocean was a ship anchored. And these men had come from that boat. And he was startled. He looked at him and says, "What are you doing here?" They said, "Well, we came to rescue you." "Well, how did you know I was here to rescue?" They said, "We saw your smoke signals." what we interpret to be tragedy can be used for good. As a matter of fact, you know Romans 8:28, for God works all things for the good to those that love Him and are called according to His purpose. Interesting, the word for good, agathos, has to do with spiritual good. Paul didn't say everything is good. It says God works everything for the good. God's in charge of the evil and the good. And God uses it all to work out in His purpose. I have seen and gone through hardship in my own life where you wonder really what God's trying to say. I had a nice business. We had a nice home. Things going very well. And then two car accidents. About 7 or 8 years apart. Put me on disability. I was self-employed. Some friends tried to do my work for me, but they couldn't keep up. They had their own jobs. So we lost the business. We lost our home. We lost pretty much everything. And at the time, we were pastoring the little church out in Sisquoc, the country church. And so we had no place to live, no money. That's like going from top to bottom real quick. So we, a family of five, we moved into this little wooden church out in the country. And we also had four dogs and a cat. It didn't work well. Let's just put it that way. Put most of our things in storage, and I'm really seeking the Lord as to why all of this is happening. I just like you just... You just lose everything, almost. So for the next few years, seeking the Lord. But now in hindsight, God doesn't deliver messages out of the sky. He works in our circumstances. When things are out of our control, whether it's good or bad, God is in charge to get us to the place where He wants us to be and to do the things that He wants us to do. I found out He's not mad at me at all. He just knows I'm spiritually stupid. I can't read His mind. If somebody were to knock on my door and say, God told me to tell you, sell your business and your house, I'd say, yeah, right. Never happened. Couldn't convince me, God, that's a message from God. And yet at the same time, God speaks and He moves in everything. I received an email the other day from a wonderful couple that follows our ministry. And they had a question. He suffered a heart attack, the husband, and he just started back to work just last Monday. And she said, we've been looking to sell our house because if he has another heart attack, whether it be fatal or just crippling, we're going to be in big trouble. We won't be able to afford this house. So we're trying to sell the house. But we're also finding out that if we sell the house and just get whatever equity we have left and go find something else, we don't have enough money to afford anything around here. And I'm thinking to myself, that's enough to cause another heart attack, you know. All the stress, they're looking on the weekends, they're going down around with a real estate agent looking at places for them because they're trying to get out of a situation that might work out bad. So they asked me, what's your advice? I told them, first of all, figuring out anything in the future is the most difficult thing for a Christian. You don't know. And even when you think you know, you find out you don't know. So I said, the only thing I can do with you is share where the Lord has brought me to through various difficulties in my own life. Is that follow Him. Don't you set out to do something, just follow Him. Let Him take the lead. And that's kind of strange for Christians, because they think that if you do nothing, God's going to do nothing. And how do you know what God's doing? You got to be kidding. He's God. When He moves and He does something, you know it's God. He's in charge of everything. So my advice to them was, just sit back and follow what God does. And if God's not doing anything, that's your answer. You follow Him. Don't look for Him to say, go down about 3 blocks and turn left and go down 2 blocks and turn right, and the house that I have for you is the second one on the corner. It doesn't work that way. We are deceiving ourselves when we think that we're looking for directions from God that we have to go out and obey. We never know what that is. You never know if it's God. You don't even know if it's a Satan appearing as an angel of light. Can't even go by an open door. How do you know Satan's not opening the door? But rather let God go. Many people have come up and asked in the last few months. They said, well, the job situation's bad, and so we're looking for a place, and they're telling me what city they're looking in. They said, we just can't find anything. I said, whoa, 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 let's back up. Let's back up to square A. Who said you had to move? Oh, you did. Well, things just aren't working. Can you pay for the house? Well, right now we can, but wait. Just follow the Lord. If He's providing for you to pay for that house and He's not moving you elsewhere, there's nowhere to go. But you see, we make the decisions we have to do something and then we pray about it. You know? Lord, help us find that house that we say we have to have, that we have to move to, that we, you know, the new city that we got to go to, that we decided we have to go there. We think God is there to direct us. No, we are here to follow Him. Jesus said the proper position is to follow behind me, Jesus said. And I have found in my own life, it is impossible. If you have Jesus Christ by His Spirit living within you, it is impossible for nothing to be happening. I'm not talking about miracles and mystical things or anything else that you see. Nothing from the outside, but inside there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of changes being made. Renewing of the mind. To understand things God's ways instead of my ways. A lot of stuff going on. It's impossible for the Holy Spirit to be dormant. He doesn't take any days off. He's powerful enough to make the universe and sustain it until He's through with it. And I have His fullness living inside of me, and there's nothing going on. I've heard that too. If I don't do something, then nothing will happen. I said, let's talk about salvation for a minute. Do you really have Jesus within you? Can you really say that if you and your human effort, if you stop, nothing will happen? It's impossible. Absolutely impossible. Whether in the human we evaluate it as good or bad, it is impossible for nothing to be happening. God's in charge of everything. He works everything out for the good. It doesn't say everything is good from our human evaluation. But it does tell us that God's in charge no matter what it is. No matter what it is. In verse 33 of our text, Pilate entered into the judgment hall again and called Jesus and said unto him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" The Greek text expects the answer, yes. He's saying, "You're the King of the Jews, aren't you?" Jesus answered him, "Sayest thou this thing of yourself, or did somebody else tell you? You come to your own conclusion, or did they tell you that I said that?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew?" The Greek text expects the answer, "No. I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" He asked against the law to ask the prisoner, "Tell me what you've done wrong." That's where we got the fifth from. Verse 36, Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight." Literally, it's in the imperfect tense with a subjunctive particle that means, up until now, my servants would have been fighting if my kingdom is from out of the earth as a source. So that I would not be delivered to the Jews. But now is my kingdom not from here? Pilate therefore said unto him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You have said that I am a king. To this end was I born, and for this cause came I into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone that is of the truth heareth my voice." And Pilate says, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again unto the Jews and said unto them, "I find in him no fault at all." So then he presents something else to them in 39 and 40. He says, "You have a custom that I should release unto you at the Passover a prisoner. Will you therefore that I release unto you the King of the Jews?" And they cried all the more again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas," literally Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a robber. Barabbas was the most notorious criminal in the prison system. And the Romans would release to the Jewish people a prisoner at Passover time as a gift. Choose whatever prisoner you want loose. Some political activist. We're told in the scriptures that Barabbas was not only a thief, he was a murderer. And what is interesting in this whole scene, Barabbas is Aramaic. Bar means son, and Abba means father. Barabbas means son of the father. So, he's going to release Barabbas. How would you like to have Barabbas back into your community? A thief and a murderer. Just as long as you keep Jesus locked up. He went about and did nothing but good. Healed people. Ministered to people. We don't want anybody like Jesus in our neighborhood. We want Barabbas. Yeah, that makes sense. But you can understand the narrative now as we're leading up to the cross is that the Son of God, the Son of the Father in his own right, substituted himself for Barabbas, Son of the Father. Very interesting. After the break, I talk a little bit more about the truth at the end of chapter 18, what does that mean, truth? What does it mean that everybody who hears the truth, that is of the truth, hears my voice? We'll take about 8 minutes break, and then we'll get back at it.